This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Though her lands are fertile and rich in biodiversity, Ethiopia grapples with famine and poverty and relies on food aid to feed its starving population. But at the same time, sales of huge land areas of Ethiopia by the Ethiopian government to foreign investors have led to starvation and forced displacement. In his documentary, Dead Donkeys Fear No Hyenas, Swedish filmmaker Joachim Demmer exposes the consequences of land grabbing and how this chase for green gold has caused mass displacement and environmental hazards to the people of Ethiopia. He joins me now to share more. Welcome, Joachim. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you in the studio. So maybe we can get to know you a little bit better. I mean, tell me, how did you get into filmmaking?
Well, it's a long story, but I've been working as a filmmaker since 20 years almost. I'm of Swedish origin, but I'm based in Berlin since almost 15 years.
Okay. So we want to talk about Dead Donkeys Fear No Hyenas today, and this obviously is set in Ethiopia. So what were you doing in Ethiopia? You know, what kind of sparked this whole thing?
This story started for me kind of coincidentally. I was doing another film in Ethiopia, a music documentary, and on the way back when I was waiting at the airport, I could see that in the same time as food products from Ethiopia intended for export mm-hmm. was loaded on airplanes, food aid for the starving population were brought into the country. And this was, of course, very much a paradoxy. And, of course, my curiosity was triggered by this scene. So I decided to return back to Ethiopia and was pretty soon I then realized there's a huge thing going on there, mm-hmm. and not only in Ethiopia, it's happening in most sub-Saharan African countries, also in Latin America, also in Asia it's happening, and today even in Eastern Europe. And it's very much connected to the food crisis, the global food crisis in 2008, mm-hmm. where suddenly food prices on the international market were spiking. And this caused not only like the Arabic Spring, because when the bread prices were rising, yes. People were taken to the streets and were destabilizing a lot of countries. It also gave a signal to investors, global investors. Before, food was kind of, and land was kind of some very special interest for a very little club of investors. Mm-hmm. But now investors realize that, okay, the population of Earth is rising all the time, but arable land is decreasing all the time.
Sure.
So this promise in the long term, good profits. So suddenly a lot of investors who before had not been dealing with land went into the business. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, when the financial markets got more unstable, a lot of insurance companies, retirement companies, they were looking for how can we put our money in a safe way. You know, shares was a bit difficult, you know, real estate was spiking also, but okay, land was seems to be a very safe investment in the long term. Mm-hmm. So this caused a kind of, you know, a rush for the so-called green gold. And when that was starting, a lot of people were jumping on the train, mm-hmm. you know, so the bubble, or not really a bubble, but the snowball was rolling. And this have affected millions of people around the world. Because when there is a strong interest for land has to be taken somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most arable land in the world is actually already used.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this had the consequence that the people who were using this land, in many cases, have been displaced by different degrees of violence. In Ethiopia, this happened was more easily to do because a very centralized government, the land officially belongs, is like a heritage of the former Marxist regime,
sure.
where all land belonged to the state.
Yeah.
So now the federal government are controlling the land. They are the owner of the land and they have the right to distribute the land to foreign investors, even if it's used by peasant farmers who have been living there for, the families have been living there for since the beginning of history. And this was what was happening. People were forced away with the help of pressure from soldiers and militaries. There was a lot of acts of violence. Mm-hmm. And this was happening in a country where actually already millions of people were living on the brink of starvation. And so these people, they were losing their livelihood and now become dependent of food aid. So it was an extremely absurd situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you, through your research and everything, you found that the World Bank, its shareholders, like, the US and the EU, for example, they all played a role in this. And they're basically, in other words, supporting the mechanisms of land grabbing.
Yes, it's something. I mean, like the World Bank, I mean, they have, the official goal is to support development and do good. Mm-hmm. But actually what we found out in Ethiopia was that a huge multi-billion dollar aid program actually was misused by the Ethiopian government. They were using this development program as an alibi for evicting people. They said that in order to make people be able to benefit from this program, mm-hmm. we have to move them away. Sure. To centralize them in new villages,
sure. yeah,
so they could get this great help. But strangely, the land they were then leaving was given over to investors. So the Ethiopian government were tricking the World Bank. Now one can say, okay, is maybe the World Bank also is a victim here, but not really. The World Bank has been working for decades. They know what happened. They know how to be careful. They have to be careful with all aid programs. There's always a dark side of aid. But they ignored it. And later when, of course, the reports came that people were evicted and the people who were executing the evictions were paid by money from the aid program of the World Bank.
The aid program?
Yes, yes. They were taken from the salaries of the executioners,
oh, wow.
of the civil servants. It was a big machinery, you know, police officers and like that. They were paid by this supposedly aid program. Okay, voices came up about this. And sooner or later, the World Bank were forced to, you know, put up a research team and send it to supposedly find
investigate.
Out. To investigate it. But when the report came out, it was like, yeah, there are some rumors about forced evictions, rape, but we cannot, you know, confirm it. But the thing is that actually the translator who were on these missions, they were recording the interviews they made with the local people. And there are tales, evidence of systematic violence. It means that the report from the World Bank to the World Bank was whitewashed, you know, to disguise what was actually happening there. And this can be proved in the transcripts from the interviews they made, the researchers were made, that are available for anyone want to listen to it. They are hiding the proofs of how their development program was misused for evicting people.
So they falsified, basically, then?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so let's say that when the Ethiopian government were removing the people, I mean, some of them might have agreed to it, right? Were they made some empty promises, for example, that didn't quite, well, that, you know, didn't come to fruition?
They were made promises, but none of these promises were held.
Right.
You know, they were promised new land. But the new land they got was non-arable land, you know,
right.
where they couldn't plant anything. There was no water, you know. They were promised health care. You know, there was no health care. They were promised schools. There were no schools, you know. So these people, you know, in a lot of parts of Africa, the life is very strongly connected to land. Without land, you are nothing.
Mm-hmm.
All the culture is based also on land, especially among the indigenous people, where the land is also where the bones of the ancestor are buried.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole system, not a lifestyle, but a culture. When the land is taken away from them, their culture will die. Yeah,
yep.
And that's what they told me. You know, they were. It's sometimes we are very ignorant to indigenous people. We think they are, you know, simple-minded and like that, but this is not really the case. So the people we meet in the film and we are interviewing with, they are simple farmers, but they are very aware of what is happening, you know. They know that, they told me, you know, that they don't want expecting the film to change really something for them, but they said, at least we know that in 10 years we are gone. Yeah, Our people are gone then. But at least we want to have our voices, you know, for some kind of eternity because of this happening.
I'm speaking today to Joachim Demmer. He's a filmmaker and his film Dead Donkeys Fear No Hyenas kind of chronicles how sales of huge land areas in Ethiopia by the government to foreign investors has led to starvation and forced displacement among the Ethiopians. And after this quick break, we'll find out how Joachim actually got into Ethiopia and made that film, which took, I think, 7 years. It was 7 years in the making?
Yes.
We'll find out more after this quick break. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is filmmaker Joachim Demmer. His film, Dead Donkeys Fear No Hyenas, confronts and redefines conventional Western understanding of international development by examining the toll this practice has taken on Ethiopia in particular. So, Joachim, we were talking about, you know, how the people wanted their voices heard. Can you take me back to the start of how you actually even attacked this film, the making of this film? You know, so you saw what happened in the airport, you went back to Ethiopia, and I mean, I know you had to keep going in and out very covertly and doing everything under the radar.
Yeah. First thing, Ethiopia at that time was turning more into a very strict dictatorship with no freedom for media. And the land issue is a very controversial one. Mm-hmm. So if you want to report on that area, you know, it's a no-go, sure. Seriously.
Sure.
So, and also knowing that I'm, as a non-Ethiopian, to tell this story, I knew I had to go on the inside of the story, and that I could only do with the cooperation with Ethiopians.
Sure.
Yeah. And I was very lucky to meet a senior senior environmental journalist. He was already a legend at that time because he started environmental journalism in Ethiopia.
Wow.
And was kind of, you know, supporting all younger journalists, you know, to report on this issue. And he was also the one who disclosed the secret, at that time, secret plans of the government to give away millions of hectares of land. That was his one of his big scoops. And he was very willing to help me, and he then also became one of the main characters in the film,
sure.
Argava Shine. And so I started to travel with him around the country, sometimes more or less undercover, you know, sometimes completely undercover, sometimes under some other project.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Yeah, so we travel a lot in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always strange that when you see this difference between the reality in the capital. I mean, most capitals you can see a nice life and it looks like the modernity is coming and development. But to see the consequences, one always have to go out in the periphery. And then you can see it. And that was very obvious in Ethiopia, where people in the new so-called villages, which was only like sheds and different sheds where they had put up a sign, school, another shed with a sign of healthcare, you know, like a fake Potemkin village.
Yeah, I mean, we see that in Malaysia as well. You know, so many different countries we see that. Okay, but let's focus on Ethiopia. So, you had this young journalist to help you, but I'm sure there were many other collaborators. And talk to me about the people who you did end up meeting.
Yeah, we met a lot. Beside Argava Shine, we were very happy to meet Omot at that time when we met him first. He was working with a national park in Gambela.
Mm-hmm.
Already at that time, he was fearing that the government would give away land from the national park also to the investors.
The national parks included?
Yes,
wow.
Yes. Okay. And this did happen. And when he was protesting, he was kicked out of the office. But he's a very upright guy, so he went on protesting and he then later had to flee Gambela to hide in the capital. Later in the film, during the shooting, he also had to, he was arrested and put in jail for, he was on his way to a workshop organized by the Swiss church in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And this was branded as a terrorist meeting by the government. And they put him into a black site first. But we couldn't find out where he was. And so a lot of NGOs were contacted and embassies. So he was put more in an official prison, but he was tortured severely. And this process went on then further during the filming and until afterwards, when there has been a change in the government now in Ethiopia. And then he was released, but he's still very traumatized by the torture
mm-hmm.
and this experience. So we really hope that he will be able to find back to a normal life in a way. I've also been traveling Cambodia and in South Sudan, and it's very impressive to see that you have this kind of people who are courageous, you know, would do the right thing in spite of all the risks they are taking, you know. And I think that's very much like when we sometimes we're looking down on, you know, the civil society in these countries. But these are, you know, these people are the real heroes, I think, today, you know, because they do these things in spite of know what might happen.
Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, he was under trial as well?
He was under trial, but it was a fake trial. There was no proofs, anything, you know.
Yep,
so at the end, he was released because of the pressure from internationally. And now he's released and he's living in, for now he's in Kenya and under treatment, medical treatment.
Okay, because he was like separated from his family for quite a while,
he? Yes, 3 years almost.
Right, he wasn't allowed to travel because of the pending, they
yes,
kept his
exactly,
passport.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the sacrifice that somebody had
yes,
to make. Yeah.
Yes, and I mean, even if people are heroes in a way, it's
comes at a heavy price.
It's a heavy price. It's a really heavy price.
Yeah, I mean, who knows the psychological trauma that he is probably dealing with right, from the torture. And another thing that you mentioned earlier, you know how there was testimonies of violence, rape, even betrayal. Is that the kind of climate that, you know, that's happening over there that, you know, you can't really trust? I mean, I remember reading that there's spies everywhere. If like there's four people, one of them might be a spy in a conversation. I remember reading that.
Yes, I mean, they in Ethiopia, they had in a way taken over during the Marxist time. They had taken over a Soviet Union style of controlling population, building networks of spies, you know, like in the schools, universities, working spaces, all over. So in a way, it was only in the family where you could be more or less safe about.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And this is also a way of creating fear, you know. It's like not directly maybe to catch a spy or an opposition guy there. It's about to create fear, that people feel a fear, that you don't dare to act.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of this system. That's the overwhelming fear all over to protest. But what has happened in Ethiopia is that when, because the land issue became so were moving so many people and the question of democracy, more and more people came to the street. So they were killing a lot of people, demonstrators, and putting 10,000 in jail, but they were not able to stop it. And so the land was turning to the brink on civil war. And then there was a change in the government because you had all the hardliners
mm-hmm.
who just wanted to use military force. And then you had more the younger, more people who understand this will take us down the abyss. You know, if you go that path, you know. And then there has been a change. We're still waiting to see if it's a real change. It's a bit like, I think, in Malaysia now, without doing any further comparing. But the new government, they also have to prove. I mean, they have made the promises.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're about to have to prove, you know, what will actually be done. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as we can see, like in all countries where you don't have... where real law is not ruling, you know, a real true law, and where the constitutions are politically, you know, it will always lead to a destabilization of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also a way, like, also on the, sometimes people, I also have a lot of contact with business people, also like in Ethiopia, and for them, the destabilization is so bad for business. So I think it's like there's a, amongst the clever business people, it's coming, you know, the insight that democracy and inclusion and that wealth is shared to a certain degree, at least, you know, that is good for business because it brings stabilization and it brings a wealth which creates customers, you know. And that's kind of, I think there's a shift coming where these insights are, there are the old school still war, like, you know, ruin the environment and like that. But if you talk about a lot of businessmen, they also have children, you know, they're also worried about, will there be a future for my children? Will there be any forest left over, you know?
Climate change.
Will
yeah.
the sea be, will we be, my children be able to go swimming, you know? So it's like the problem is so, are so obvious that even, you know, you cannot only look on the close commercial interest anymore. Mm-hmm. That's obvious to a lot of business people nowadays also.
So that is, there is a change that you are witnessing as well.
I think that's, yeah, because we are in the same boat, you know. Even if we are wealthy, you know, we cannot hide in our better apartment or better house. I mean, sooner, you know, there is no sooner or no nice beaches left, you know, because the plastic will be all over, you know. So even if you go to the most expensive resort, exclusive one, you will meet it, you know. There is no hiding from it in the long term.
Well, the weather changes, the weather patterns
will come and find you at your doorstep.
Whether you like it or not. Just speaking about the role of the business, I mean, the investors that you did identify in the film, and I mean, after the film came out, how did they sort of respond to your film?
Well, there are different kinds of investors in the film also.
Sure.
We met a British farmer, who was a very interesting guy because he was very much working together. For him, it was not a conflict between including the local people and working for the benefit also for the people in the area and making profits. He was also producing for the domestic market.
Okay.
So that means that that would support the country from food security, but also for the exchange of currency. Because if he was producing so and so many ton of wheat, Ethiopia would not have to import this wheat.
So
that was. Then we had another investor who, with Saudi interest. And this is a big plant for rice plantation in an industrial scale with beginning with 10,000 hectares. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, it would be increased to probably 50 or even 100,000 into the national park.
Yeah.
And there it was about producing expensive basmati rice,
mm-hmm.
but not for the Ethiopian population, but for the Saudi population.
Okay.
Because in Saudi Arabia, they are not able to produce their own food, you know.
Sure.
So they go shopping in order to secure the food security for the Saudi population. They go shopping in African countries.
Right, yeah. Right. And when confronted with evidence of the violence, the rapes,
yes.
the displacement, how did they sort of respond to that, if at all?
Of course, it's like if you take the livelihood, land and livelihood away from people, there will mm-hmm. be a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And this creates a lot of anger. And anger always takes, it could go inwards where people start drinking, violence in the family or in the community, or depression or suicide, or the anger go outwards, directing towards government or towards the investors. And that did happen. You know, the Saudi farm was attacked by rebels and people were killed. And that then created, you know, like a reaction from the government who wants to protect the farms. So there came more military killing people. There were rape, you know, from the side of the military and creating more violence. So you get this
vicious cycle.
Yeah, vicious cycle, you know, and destabilizing the region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same story we can see all over again and again and again. And that's why it's not a feasible way for a country or not for companies to work in that way, because there will be a lashback from that. You know, it will always happen, you know.
Innocent lives are being lost. Yeah, I brought up the World Bank. You know, I mean, what role do you think they should play now that I mean, now that the film is out, for example, you know, there's more media, you know, coverage. You know, it's not such a hidden story anymore. Do you know? I mean, what do you think they need to do? How can they step up?
I'm not sure if it's possible to change the World Bank, because it's so much influenced by interests, national interests, or it might be from the USA or from the Europeans or from the bigger shareholders. And mostly they are working from top down.
Yeah.
And that means working top down with authoritarian governments or corrupt governments mean that people on the local level will not be included. You know,
yeah.
And that will, in the end, always will have a bad ending. You know, and we can see again and again and again and again, development project by the World Bank is creating misery instead of helping the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know really what kind of reformation is possible to do there. Actually, it's especially now when with the government in the USA we have now, it probably will not happen in this presidential time, I think.
Okay. But I mean, but you did mention that you are seeing change, and I guess the local communities, I mean, they are people who have come up to defend their land rights, like you said, and that's, I suppose, very very promising as well.
Yeah, I think Ethiopia, in a way, okay, we don't know what will happen,
sure,
how it will develop there now, but there is hope actually for transformation. You know, because there is also so many people, still there are many people who remember the civil war. You know, they know what war means, you know, and war is always bad, you know. There is no real winners from a war. And they know that, so also inside the government. So they are taking steps to change the country in a positive way, you know. It's very interesting to see, you know, governments, you can always choose, you know. You know, you don't have to go the bad way, you know.
Yes. <Yeah?
laughs>
You can be good.
things can turn positive, you know. It's possible. I mean, we could also see, as I understand it from Malaysia also, you know, it is possible. But then, of course, it's always a long and difficult way with a lot of gray tones, you know.
Yeah.
And it's always difficult politically when there's a lot of hopes, you know, and dreams. And it's very difficult for even the best politician to fulfill those aspirations, you know.
For sure.
Politics is about a lot about people sitting in very long and boring meeting and finding compromises.
Yeah.
It's not really fascinating, or it's not really the big drama. And of course, a lot of, like in Ethiopia, where you have millions of poor people, and the dreams are, of course, of wealth, you know, or avoid hunger. And, you know, so those dreams and hopes are so big. And as we know the reality, it's very difficult to, even in long term, to do changes. Changes are slow,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
That we can also see in Europe now, when we have a lot of populist parties, you know, who are promising everything and playing on resentments against immigrants or whatever it is, you know. That's very easy. It's very easy to make fire, you know. But it's very much more difficult to build something, you know, in the long term. And it's also very difficult for politicians to communicate those little changes, because they don't look so fancy, you know. So it's difficult to get out what you actually are doing, you know.
Yeah. But it's an ongoing process, and it's
an ongoing process, and it's there is no other way, you know. There is no other way. And then, of course, you also, by reforms, it's also difficult to. It's very much about timing, you know. Because I could guess that also, like in Malaysia, where there are different people are living different time, you know. People in the bigger cities, they have like, they are in one kind of world, you know. And then people living more traditionally with traditions, and if you also consider religion, it's also important to not go too slow and not to go too fast, you know, but to find a path where people see there is a change, you know. But there is also communicate and find a diplomacy between the changes. You know, that's tricky. That's tricky. You need
diplomacy. Is tricky, isn't it?
It is tricky. Yeah, it is tricky.
So, I mean, when you made this film, when you set out to make this film, and I mean, it's a film that you face many, many obstacles to complete. I mean, what were you hoping to achieve from all of this?
I think documentary is not that you make a film to. you know, to make a change, you know, sure. Because that would also be naive, you know. A film documentary is a part of a discourse, you know, where different you have NGOs, you have organizations, also with governments. There are good people in all governments, almost. So the film is, you know, part of this talk in a way. But then film is also about, you could say it's a bit like the family, like, you know, the photo book of your family, you know. We are trying to tell the history, the ongoing history, and try to find, beside, you know, the short news reportage, you know, we are trying to go profound and tell the stories of our time. It could also be about past times, but also I'm more into the modern time, of our time, you know, to tell what is happening mm-hmm. and tell the stories or let people tell their stories of these ongoing processes.
Okay. And I guess to capture that moment in history as well.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And to speak to the people who, you know, could very easily be, as you mentioned, you know, their stories not being heard. So it's to yes. give them that voice as well.
Yeah, because I think it's very much about like what you always meet when you are working with documentaries is that people are not heard.
Yeah.
You know, and that could also be, you know, if you're doing a more private film or which is about, let's say, families, it's also in the families there are stories were not told, you know, the things the uncle did, the shamey uncle from the past or whatever. And so it's also in society. There are always in all societies, also in my country, Sweden, there are dark parts of the history, you know, how we are treating our indigenous people, mm-hmm. the Samic people. We have taken their land. You know, we have ruined their lives, their way of life, you know. And that's kind of a blind spot in the Swedish society also, how we have dealt with them, you know. There are some talking and there are, you know, the politicians, they like to appear with them in the traditional, you know, folkloristic stuff, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it comes to the hard facts, you know, changing laws, you know, about the control of the land, you know, there is no change yet, you know, because there are big interests there. And so in that sense, there is always, you know, in all families there are blind spots, you know, and in every individual there are also blind spots, you know. We are very good at seeing the weakness in other people, but not ourselves.
But
and in that way, documentary is also like also literature, and it's also a way to a mirror for ourselves, mm-hmm. for our society.
Yeah, because I mean, just reading about this film, for example, I saw, like you said, I saw so many similarities about what happens in Malaysia with, you know, our indigenous communities and
yes.
land grabbing
yes.
and, you know, this promise of a better future, which is
yes.
never actually
yes.
delivered. So
yes.
lots of...
No, we had by the screening yesterday, there were also people coming from Sabah and mm-hmm. Sark, and for them, it was very much one-to-one the same story.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's differences, of course, you know, and that's the experience we have done with the film also. We have traveling a lot with the film around the world. And
yeah.
when we show it with indigenous people or small farmers, they can very much identify themselves with the Anyak people. And I think that's also very, in a way, it's hopeful that today, you know, say people from Sabah, you know, indigenous people there, they can identify themselves with indigenous people in an outpost in the deepest Africa.
Yeah,
you know, to find the common things. You know,
yeah.
I think that is a positive way of the globalization. You know, that and I can see in Sweden our indigenous people there, they are starting communicating and having contact with other indigenous people.
Yeah, yeah, and I think they all meet for they go to protest at the COP meetings, for example.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much more cohesion. There's so much
yes.
more collaboration
yes.
between, you know, all the
yes.
different indigenous
yes.
communities across the world.
Yes,
that is promising, I suppose.
Yeah,
and we've missed the screening here in KL, but you know, if anyone would like to watch the film, you know, how can they do that? Any future plans?
One could actually see the film on video on demand.
Okay.
You know, so easiest way just to Google, you know, the title, Dead Donkeys, Fena Hyenas, and VOD,
okay.
you know, and you will find the, one will find it.
Okay, all right.
With a little bit of Google, one can find it.
Okay, and this is something I meant to ask you earlier, you know, what does the name Dead Donkeys?
It's a quote from Omot, the film, and he said that you know, he had to flee the Gambela region, his home region, to hide in Addis. But then the World Bank were sending at this assessment team, and they needed a translator. Mm-hmm. And he knew, of course, this is very dangerous for me to go back there. But I have to do to try to help find out the truth. And then he said this, you know, a dead donkey doesn't have to fear the hyenas. Because that's how he considered himself, you know, that he would get in trouble anyway, you know. He was already dead in that way. So he didn't fear really the hyenas, despite the government, the prison and that thing. So I think it's an African proverb, which mm-hmm. is actually about doing the right thing.
Despite the
repercussions. Even if there is a high price.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Joachim. And if anyone's interested, you have a website that they can go to as well?
Yeah, one can go to, there's a website, thedonkeysfearnohyenas.com. And there are more information about the issue and the film and where one can screen it also, actually.
Okay, and they can get in touch with you via the website.
Yes.
All right, okay. Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Joachim Demmer. He's a filmmaker. His film, Dead Donkeys Fear No Hyenas, chronicle how huge land areas in Ethiopia were sold by the government to foreign investors, which led to a lot of suffering and displacement and starvation by the people of Ethiopia themselves. So if you'd like to get in touch or if you'd like to find out more, that website again is deaddonkeysfearnohyenas.com. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcasts on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.